Michael Nicholson, Reel 32. Did you go to the Gulf during the crisis?
My first visit to the Gulf, in fact, was before the war began. You know, you remember, the war didn't start the way the Falklands War started overnight. There was a long build-up to it, as there is now, you know, in October 2002, a long build-up to the next war there. So I think from about October, November onwards, in October, November 1990, we knew, I mean, everyone knew that there was this ultimatum to Saddam Hussein, get out of Kuwait, otherwise we're going to come in. And troops started to move into the Gulf area. I went out there to do a preview story with the British Navy, the minesweepers, and then came home and waited for Desert Storm to begin. Desert Storm, I think the war proper started in January, didn't it? January 17th around. But for me, the build-up to the war had begun some months earlier. I was sent with Eugene Campbell, who was my cameraman, to Dubai. And then we went by sea to report on the Royal Navy's role in enforcing the UN blockade. I think what was behind this blockade was that they'd hoped that by denying Saddam all these things that his petrodollars bought, and by cutting off his oil revenue, we could reduce his capacity to buy weapons and therefore be reducing, you know, his capacity to go to war or defend himself if we went to war against him. So we had this extension, and I think it was called the Armilla Patrol. The Armilla Patrol, it was 150-odd ships from 14 nations, so it was It was called the Armilla Patrol, and it was something like 150 ships from 14 nations, so it was, you know, a fair old cross-section of support. It was quite an alliance. And it was later became known as the Coalition Task Force. But that patrol went up and down the Gulf, preventing any kind of assistance to Saddam Hussein. By the late autumn of 1990, it must have been November, the command force commanders, the coalition force commanders, announced that the blockade had been 100%. Nothing had got through into Basra through the Gulf. Turkey had also cut down its pipeline. So, you know, Sudan was now isolated. So I returned, I did this story in November about the blockade, about British presence there, and waited really for the war to begin. And in fact, I got the call to go to the Gulf on my birthday, 9th of January. I had reports from Baghdad that Saddam was massing troops on the border and actually moving his tanks across into Kuwait. So he'd completely ignored the American president's ultimatum. So the next day, 10th of January, I flew to Dubai, where I was flown by a Royal Navy helicopter to the Northern Gulf, and I joined an anti-air warfare destroyer called HMS Gloucester. And ITN reminded me that I must take the ITN-issue gas mask and the NBC suit. The NBC suit is a nuclear, biological and chemical warfare suit. It's completely sealed rubber suit, because we thought at the time, in fact many people were convinced at the time, that Saddam Hussein was going to use any one of these three components to get rid of us. One of the first things I noticed on Gloucester when I arrived there was that the Lynx helicopter pilot David Livingston had a cage full of finches. I thought it was rather quaint that a pilot should take his pet birds with him on board a destroyer. But in fact, It was a bit like the canaries and the miners. They took underground. They would give the first alert of gas, and these finches apparently would give the first alert of gas. So a very primitive early warning system. Gloucester was at the sharp end of the war because it was it had anti-air warfare, it had missiles on board, and it was also the air raid warning ship for the rest of the fleet behind us. It was also the, we were the furthest ship in the Gulf, we were the number one ship right at the very spearhead of the little armada that was in the Gulf at the time. So aircraft passing over, Allied aircraft passing over on their way to Baghdad, would get the final okay clearance from our ship. And of course when they came back from Iraq, bombing, ours would be the first ship to greet them. I talked about this NBC suit. It's, you only wore it, of course, when you're outside the ship. And the great comfort for us, because putting these things on was horrific, you know. I don't know how you could put them on quick enough to save your life if you were attacked by a missile carrying biological or nuclear or chemical warheads. Excuse me. But the great comfort for us was that at a red alert, the ship could be sealed, hermetically sealed. So if you're inside, other than a nuclear hit, you were safe from biological or chemical poisoning. It's only the poor old devils who are outside manning the guns that were at risk. The other thing that I found upsetting at the time was that you had to take something called NAPS tablets, M-A-N-A-P-S. Now I forget what those initials mean, but they were simply called NAP tablets. We were given a big supply of them. And every 4 hours, there was a tannoy. Time for your nap tablets, time for your nap, take your nap tablets. And I said, well, what are these things? And we were told by the medical officer on board that they were a kind of experimental guinea pig type tablets, which if there was a biological attack, would somehow save you from it because it affected the nerve system. Kind of short-circuited. Don't ask me how it worked, but it was supposed to help you. But I decided I was not going to be a guinea pig, so I refused to take them. Of course, being a civilian, I could refuse to take them. Every other person on board was obliged to. And I've often wondered since whether these things, NAPS tablets and all the other tablets they gave people, were responsible for what's now become known as the Gulf War Syndrome. I've never suffered, but I know a lot of people who have. Maybe it was because I refused to take those funny little tablets. Now, for me, the war proper began, as it did for everybody, on Thursday the 17th of January. I was in my bunk asleep. And suddenly I was woken up by the captain, Captain Wilcox. He said, come down and look at this. He said, you're going to find this fascinating. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I went up on deck, and not far away from us, I suppose, 600 yards, were two enormous U.S. battleships, Second World War battleships, the Wisconsin and the Missouri. We were at the time about 80 miles off the coast of Kuwait. And this was the first strike in anger, a preemptive strike of Tomahawk missiles. These astonishing things that have radar in their nose and can actually find their way to a target using a kind of little television set. It's absolutely incredible. And you know all about how they used to go down a main street and turn right at the lights. They never quite did that, but they could almost do that. And just to see this thing lifting off Missouri, this great flash as the rockets went off, and then you'd see this tall pylon suddenly hover above the deck as if it was about to kind of fail and drop down again, and shudder, and then boof, off it went. Now, I was absolutely, you know, overawed by it all, and I rushed down. I said to Wilcox, the captain, well, I must get on the phone now and let London know. I must do a phono. And he said, hold on, you know, we don't want you to let Saddam Hussein, no, it's coming. It'll take a good hour to get there. So, you know, that's how far we were away from Baghdad. But I was allowed eventually to send my messages. One of the great things about being on board the boat was that I could simply pick up a phone when I was allowed to do so, and when I had a story that I was allowed to transmit, I'd pick up a phone and ring London and do this phono piece. We had a satellite telephone on board, and I could ring directly from the bridge. Now, one of the problems with the guys in the desert who were covering the war in the desert was that, you know, sometimes they'd be away from Dahran, which was the major base, for days on end. And two, of course, they were under far more stringent censorship rules than I was. I was very lucky on Gloucester because Philip Wilcox, the captain, a very egotistical man, like most captains are, and wanted him and his ship to be featured prominently in all news reports. In fact, it became a joke, well, a joke on board on Gloucester, but not a joke on board the other British ships, that only Gloucester and Wilcox were in this war, because nobody heard of any other ship except Gloucester, because that was the only ship I was on. And there were frequent requests for me to be transferred to other ships for a few days, simply so that I could actually report from those ships and their name could be mentioned on air. But Wilcox somehow managed to keep me on board Gloucester for most of that time. I wrote in my diary that the captain... Can I just read you a bit from the diary that I wrote? It was on, I noticed, St. Valentine's Day. The captain piped today that the battle group is joining us. Battle group is joining us. There'll be more American ships coming, including Mobile Bay and Bunker Hill. The operation is coded 151. Our mine hunters are coming to clear the way in readiness for a beach landing. And maps captured from a sunken Iraqi ship show safe channels into Kuwaiti harbour. Our big guns are being stripped, cleaned, and oiled. And the Sea Dart launchers are also having a spring clean. Our captain says we are soon going to Zulu Alpha, and that is a permanent state of battle readiness, and the ship will be airtight. London, Exeter, Manchester, and Brave are moving up alongside to join us, plus the supply ships and the hospital ship Argus. And I wrote at the end, it can't be long now, and a tremendous sense of relief that something is going to happen. Dolphins are playing at the bow of our ship, and the helicopter crew is slaughtering seagulls with shotguns off the flight deck. Then a few days later, on the 16th of February, I've written, we're now the closest ship to the coast. 7 minutes flying time for Iraqi missiles to hit us, if any are left. The captain has given orders to clear all decks below, except those on essential duties. The crew prepared to close up ship in 2 minutes in case of a gas attack. I mean, we actually went through repeated, I mean, day after day, sometimes hour after hour of practice alerts. The alarm would ring, you'd hear red alert, and we had 2 minutes to get inside and close all doors so that we were airtight. 2 minutes was the time it would take for us to be told that the Iraqis had sent a missile towards us, 2 minutes it would take to get from them to us. And of course, in that time, the poor devils who were on deck had to jump into their NBC suits and prepare for the worst. On the 18th of February, I wrote this, the sea is like a pond, the winds turned around, we're still on red alert when silkworm missiles were identified on a launch pad at Falaka. That's on the Kuwaiti coast. American F-17s from carriers south have made direct hits, and we are told that we are safe. The launch pads have been taken out. Bodies of two American airmen float by our ship with their parachutes still attached. They've been picked up, I suppose, by now. I wonder how they died. Impact, thirst... They must have ejected okay. They're all in one piece. but obviously nobody picked them up. Now I got here 19th of February, much oil on the sea, and the sky in the west is black. The pilots report massive fires. Our returning Lynx helicopter is covered in oil, and the crew too. Still no beach landing. It has been called off. Now that's interesting, that item. I tell you why. Much oil on the sea, and still no beach landing. Now that reminds me that those two items, oil and the beach landing, were the two biggest bits of black propaganda, misinformation, that we passed on to an unsuspecting public. All the way up the Gulf, we had been joined by USS Tripoli, a huge aircraft carrier, massive aircraft carrier, with 3,000 Marines on board, US Marines. We'd been allowed to film the ship. We'd been given a facility to see the US Marines training on board, doing all kinds of exercises not normally associated with the Marines. We were shown that they had landing craft, and they were given landing craft exercises, all pointing to the fact that these Marines were going to be used for a beach invasion. Now, oddly enough, we were allowed to broadcast that fact. Now, that surprised me at the time, and I should have known better. I should have been more suspicious. You know, why should the Navy and the Americans allow us, British journalists, me a British journalist, to report the fact that we have 3,000 Marines, landing craft, obviously is going to be a beach landing. Item one. Item two, oil. We were told that in the ultimate scorched earth policy, Saddam Hussein had ordered for all the oil wells to be blown up and all the huge distilleries to have their pipelines destroyed so the oil would flow into the Persian Gulf. It would be the biggest environmental disaster ever. We were told that the Gulf would be polluted to the end of this century. And that it was just a manic effort to save himself and causing enormous, incalculable damage to the Gulf and wildlife and everything else. Now, of course, it was a big story. Every time a helicopter pilot went up, we kept saying, you know, did you see the slick, the oil slick? We were told this oil slick was already 19 miles long and 10 miles wide. Some of the reporters on the beaches had birds covered in oil, but you know, the big shot, the big picture would be shot from the air. But still the pilot said, no, you know, there's this oil slick here, there's a little oil slick there, but nothing on the scale that's been reported. Now, I mentioned these two things, the beach landing and the oil, for one reason, in that they never existed. There was never intended to be a beach landing. There never was an oil slick of that magnitude. It was part of the propaganda put out by the British, the Allied forces to confuse. If we could broadcast every night that, you know, there was going to be a beach landing, infer there was going to be a beach landing, Saddam Hussein had to keep thousands and thousands of troops along that coast. He had emplacements there, and they were all full of men. He had to keep men there so that he had fewer men in the desert. That was the whole ploy. That was the ploy. Make him believe that there was going to be a beach landing, so he had to keep troops he desperately needed in the desert on that coast. Clever. And we helped to convince him that was what was going to happen. And as far as the oil slick was concerned, again, although he did set fire to the oil wells, there was no slick in of that magnitude in the Gulf. It was simply propaganda to incense the American and British public, world opinion, that this man was a maniac. So we helped to, in this black propaganda, this misinformation.
Did that worry you? When you heard, you know, that you really had been used.
Well, you see, I had been used, as we all had been used, in the Falklands 10 years earlier. And here we were being used again. But you don't know you're being used until afterwards. I mean, I should have been suspicious that we were being allowed to transmit the fact that the Tripoli was there, that the Marines were there, there was going to be a beach landing. I should have thought, why are we being given these facilities? Why are we being given this freedom to broadcast it? But, you know, you don't know, do you? You can't ignore. And you don't dare risk not giving out this, you know, tremendous news story. No, you have to go with it. And it's only months later that you realise you've been duped.
And also, as you've said, the fact that the troops were kept in that area and not in the desert, it helped win the war?
Of course it did, yes. It saved lives. It saved lives. So I don't feel angry about it, but I just realise that I suppose I feel slightly gratified that my early suspicion that something is not quite right here was the right intuition. It didn't stop me broadcasting it. Are we still running? Yes, our constant threat, of course, was mines. We had mine hunters, 6 mine hunters with us, and they were moving up the Gulf, clearing mines, making it a safe channel for us and the ships behind us to move closer and closer to the Kuwaiti-Iraqi coast. It was quite a complicated procedure, clearing mines, and I won't go into it, but it takes time, it's very slow, very laborious. And, you know, these weren't sophisticated mines either. Saddam was using mines made in the Second World War. You've seen them in the movies, that big black ball with spikes on. Second World War mines being used in the Gulf War surprised everybody. And they were for real, because we actually saw one come floating down past us. And believe it or believe it not, and we've got it on film, they used the end of a broomstick to push it away from the side of our ship. Had it hit us, of course, we'd have blown up. And again, here we were on one of the most sophisticated ships in the Royal Navy, with all kinds of technology and a chock-a-block with, you know, technology. And yet, we had to use a broomstick to push the mine off our hull. And the only way we could search for mines was to have a man sitting at the bow, at the tip of the ship, in a little tent, makeshift tent, with a radio telephone and a pair of binoculars. And he sat there. They had 2-hour watches, and they sat there, and if they saw anything suspicious, they would telephone the bridge, and all binoculars would come out, and we'd do a little detour. And that's how we avoided mines. I remember on one occasion, it's up on the bridge, and we suddenly hear this hysterical little voice shouting, "Mine, sir! Mine, sir!" And the captain said, "How do you know it's a mine?" "Well, it's a bloody great ball with spikes on, sir." So quick, you know, 15 degrees starboard, and off we go. But and of course, once we sighted these mines, the only way to get rid of them was to machine gun them. And I tell you, I had some pretty bad shots in the Royal Navy. It took quite a long time sometimes an awful lot of rounds to blow it up. But it was very comforting at 100, 200 yards to see this explosion. I know there was one less around. I'll tell you another story too. The Americans had an extremely expensive ship. I think it was the most expensive ship in the world. It was called the Princeton, there was a piece of arithmetic I remember at the time that said that it cost a billion dollars for every inch. It was so packed with high tech. It was, as I said, the most expensive ship in the world. Now, the British mine hunters had cleared this channel, and whenever we stopped, we stayed in that channel. But Tripoli and Princeton decided they wouldn't, for reasons best known to the US admirals at the time, they decided that they didn't either trust the British Minehunter Channel or decided they would had no anyway, whatever it was, they didn't park there. And Princeton was actually blown up by one of these Second World War mines. And this most expensive ship that was going to be invaluable to us was actually towed back to Bahrain. Astonishing. We were allowed to broadcast that. The Brits were quite chuffed about that. We had problems, of course, sending our film back. Not so bad as the Falklands, of course. We weren't talking in thousands of miles there. We were talking hundreds of miles. Bahrain was our nearest feed point, which meant that whenever we filmed anything, I was doing phono pieces, that is, telephone reports, sometimes two, three times a day from Gloucester. But to get our film back, we had to wait for a helicopter that was going back there. And of course, they weren't always helicopters going back there. And what was difficult for me as a journalist, television journalist, was that I would report an incident or a story, you know, 1 o'clock on the Monday. I'd also film it, of course. I would have filmed it before I transmitted my telephone piece. But if I didn't get my film back or my video back to Bahrain that same day, by the next day it was history and it had been overtaken by another event. So it was very, very difficult. Now, Wilcox was very cooperative in this respect, but of course we only had one helicopter, and that Lynx helicopter was being used because it had missiles on board, skewer missiles. Was attacking Iraqi shipping. So it was very difficult. We had this problem. And I remember on one occasion, Wilcox allowed Eugene Campbell, my cameraman, to go up in on a Lynx attack. They took one less skewer in order to put Eugene on board. And he got some tremendous stuff. And going in on an attack, a skewer going off, the pilots, lovely stuff coming back, you know, thumbs in the air, and, you know, we'd made another kill, blah, 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 blah. And I said to Wilcox, well, you know, we've got, and I reported this on telephone to London, injected into the programs. I said, we've got to get this video back to Bahrain. He said, well, I can't, you know, this helicopter's off again. I said, we'll get another helicopter, get it from another ship. And he said, well, I'll try, but the answer came back no. Now, the nearest ship to us was HMS London. That was the kind of flagship. And the Commodore in charge of our little task force had the strange name of the initials SNOMI, which is Senior Naval Officer Middle East, SNOMI. It was a Commodore, and he outrightly refused to allow a helicopter to be used for this. And I said, well, look, come on, this is great propaganda. It's great for the Navy. It's one of the best stories we'll have had in this war. No, absolutely no. So, I got on to, I rang up my editor, David Nicholas. I have to say, Wilcox allowed this. I'm surprised he did, because he was, in a way, going over his own senior commander's head. But I rang up David Nicholas, my editor, and I said, look, we've got this story. We've got to get it out, but they won't give us a helicopter.